tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
All right, welcome back to part 30 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am Ted Midward. This is RadioAryan.com. Okay, the first half of today's episode starts with an article entitled, Dr. Levy, a Jew, admits his people's error. A Jew of standing, Dr. Oscar Levy, well known in English literary circles and a lover of his people, has had the honesty and the wisdom to meet the Jewish question with truth and candor. His remarks are printed in this article as an example of the methods by which Jewry can be saved in the estimation of 20th century civilization. The circumstances were these. George Pitt Rivers, of Worcester College, Oxford, wrote a most illuminating brochure entitled The World Significance of the Russian Revolution, which is published and sold for 2 shillings by Basil Blackwell, Oxford. The book is the result of unprejudiced observation and study and agrees with the statements made in the Dearborn Independent about the personnel of Bolshevism. The manuscript was sent to Dr. Oscar Levy as a representative Jew, and Dr. Levy's letter was subsequently published as a preface to the book. That the reader may understand the tenor of Mr. Pitt Rivers' book, section 16, pages 39 to 41, is herewith given in full and is followed by Dr. Levy's comments. The italics throughout are intended to remind the reader of remarks on similar lines made in this series. Here is the excerpt. It is not unnaturally claimed by Western Jews that Russian Jewry, as a whole, is most bitterly opposed to Bolshevism. Now, although there is a great measure of truth in this claim, since the prominent Bolsheviks, who are preponderantly Jewish, do not belong to the Orthodox Jewish Church, it is yet possible, without laying oneself open to the charge of anti-Semitism, to point to the obvious fact that Jewry, as a whole, has, consciously or unconsciously, worked for and promoted an international economic material despotism which, with Puritanism as an ally, has tended in an ever-increasing degree to crush national and spiritual values out of existence and to substitute the ugly and deadening machinery of finance and factory. It is also a fact that Jewry, as a whole, strove every nerve to secure and heartily approved of the overthrow of the Russian monarchy, which they regarded as their most formidable obstacle in the path of their ambitions and business pursuits. All this may be admitted as well as the plea that, individually or collectively, most Jews may heartily detest the Bolshevik regime, yet it is still true that the whole weight of Jewry was in the revolutionary scales against the Tsar's government. It is true their apostate brethren, who are now riding in the seat of power, may have exceeded their orders. That is disconcerting, but it does not alter the fact. It may be that the Jews, often the victims of their own idealism, have always been instrumental in bringing about the events they most heartily disapprove of. That, perhaps, is the curse of the wandering Jew. Certainly, it is from the Jews themselves that we learn most about the Jews. It is possible that only a Jew can understand a Jew. Nay, more, it may be that only a Jew can save us from the Jews. a Jew who is great enough, strong enough, for greater racial purity is a source of strength in the rare and the great, and inspired enough to overcome in himself the life-destructive vices of his own race. It was a Jew who said, "Wars are the Jew's harvest, but no harvest so rich as civil wars." A Jew reminds us that the French Revolution brought civil emancipation for the Jews in Western Europe. Was it a Jew who inspired Rousseau with the 18th century idea of the sameness of man according to nature? Dr. Callan, a Zionist author, writes this: "Suffering for 1,000 years from the assertion of their difference from the rest of mankind, they accepted eagerly the escape from suffering which the 18th century assertion of the sameness of all men opened to them. They threw themselves with passion into the republican emancipating movements of their fellow subjects of other stocks." End quote. It was a Jew, Ricardo, who gave us the 19th century ideal of the sameness of man according to machinery. And without the Ricardian gospel of international capitalism, we could not have had the international gospel of Karl Marx. Moses Hess and Benjamin Disraeli remind us of the particularly conspicuous part played by Jews in the Polish and Hungarian rebellions and in the Republican uprising of Germany in 1848. Even more conspicuous were they in the new internationalism, logically deducible from the philosophy of socialism. This we were taught by the Jew Karl Marx and the Jew Ferdinand LaSalle, and they but developed the doctrine of the Jew David Ricardo. It was Weininger, a Jew, and also a Jew hater, who explained why so many Jews are naturally communists. Communism is not only an international creed, but it implies the abnegation of real property, especially property in land, and Jews, being international, have never acquired a taste for a real property. They prefer money. Money is an instrument of power, though eventually, of course, communists claim that they will do away with money, when their power is sufficiently established to enable them to command goods and exercise despotic sway without it. Thus, the same motives prompt the Jew communist and his apparent enemy, the financial Jew. When owners of real property in times of economic depression feel the pinch of straitened circumstances, it is the Jewish usurers who become most affluent and who, out of the goodness of their hearts, come to the assistance, at a price, of course. Now, with all that being said, to these and other statements, Dr. Levy, or Levi, as a Jew, made this reply: "Dear Mr. Pitt Rivers, when you first handed me your MS on the world significance of the Russian Revolution, you expressed a doubt about the propriety of its title. After a perusal of your work, I can assure you, with the best of consciences, that your misgivings were entirely without foundation. No better title than The World Significance of the Russian Revolution could have been chosen, for no event in any age will finally have more significance for our world than this one. We are still too near to see clearly this revolution, this portentous event, which was certainly one of the most intimate and therefore least obvious aims of the world conflagration, hidden as it was at first by the fire and smoke of national enthusiasms and patriotic antagonisms. It was certainly very plucky of you to try and throw some light upon an event which necessarily must still be enveloped in mist and mystery, and I was even somewhat anxious lest your audacity in treating such a dangerous subject would end in failure, or what is nearly the same, in ephemeral success. No age is so voracious of its printed offspring as ours. There was thus some reason to fear lest you had offered to this modern Kronos only another mouthful of his accustomed nourishment for his immediate consumption. I was, I'm glad to report, agreeably surprised. Surprised, though not by the many new facts which you give, and which you must surprise all those who take an interest in current events, facts, I believe, which you have carefully and personally collected and selected, not only from books, but from the lips and letters of Russian eyewitnesses and sufferers, from foes, as well as from friends of the Great Revolution. What I appreciate more than this new light thrown on a dark subject, more than the conclusion drawn by you from this wealth of facts, is the psychological insight which you display in detecting the reasons why a movement so extraordinarily bestial and so violently crazy as the revolution was able to succeed and finally to overcome its adversaries. For we are confronted with two questions which need answering and which, in my opinion, you have answered in your pamphlet. These questions are, number one, how has the Soviet government, admittedly the government of an insignificant minority, succeeded not only in maintaining but in strengthening its position in Russia after 2.5 years of power? And number two, why has the Soviet government, in spite of its outward bestiality and brutal tyranny, succeeded in gaining the sympathies of an increasing number of people in this country? You rightly recognize that there is an ideology behind it, and you clearly diagnose it as an ancient ideology. For there is nothing new under the sun. It is even nothing new that this sun rises in the east. For Bolshevism is a religion and a faith. How could these half-converted believers ever dream to vanquish the truthful and faithful of their own creed, these holy crusaders who had gathered round the red standard of the prophet Karl Marx and who fought under the daring guidance of these experienced officers of all latter-day revolutions, the Jews? I am touching here on a subject which, to judge from your own pamphlet, is perhaps more interesting to you than any other. In this, you are right. There is no race in the world more enigmatic, more fatal, and therefore more interesting than the Jews. Every writer who, like yourself, is oppressed by the aspect of the present and embarrassed by his anxiety for the future must try to elucidate the Jewish question and its bearing upon our age. For the question of the Jews and their influence on the world, past and present, cuts to the root of all things, and should be discussed by every honest thinker, however bristling with difficulties it is, however complex the subject, as well as the individuals of this race may be. For the Jews, as you are aware, are a sensitive community, and thus very suspicious of any Gentile who tries to approach them with a critical mind. They are always inclined, and on that account of their terrible experiences, to denounce anyone who is not with them as against them, as tainted with medieval prejudice, as an intolerant antagonist of their faith and of their race. Nor could I, would I, deny that there is some evidence, some prima facie evidence of this antagonistic attitude in your pamphlet. You point out, and with fine indignation, the great danger that springs from the prevalence of Jews in finance and industry, and from the preponderance of Jews in rebellion and revolution. You reveal, with great fervor, the connection between the collectivism of the immensely rich international finance, the democracy of cash values, as you call it, and the international collectivism of Karl Marx and Trotsky, the democracy of and by decoy cries. And all this evil and misery, the economic as well as the political, you trace back to one source, to one fons et origo malorum, the Jews. Now other Jews may vilify and crucify you for these outspoken views of yours. I myself shall abstain from joining the chorus of condemnation. I shall try to understand your opinions and your feelings, and having once understood them, as I think I have, I can defend you from the unjust attacks of my often too impetuous race. But first of all, I have to say this. There is scarcely an event in modern Europe that cannot be traced back to the Jews. Take the Great War that appears to have come to an end. Ask yourself of what were its causes and its reasons. You will find them in nationalism. You will at once answer that nationalism has nothing to do with the Jews, who, as you have just proved to us, are the inventors of the international idea. But no less than Bolshevist ecstasy and financial tyranny can national bigotry, if I may call it so, be finally followed back to a Jewish source. Are they not the inventors of the chosen people myth, and is it not this obsession part and parcel of the political credo of every modern nation, however small and significant it may be? And then think of the history of nationalism. It started in our time as a reaction against Napoleon. Napoleon was the antagonist of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was the consequence of the German Reformation. The German Reformation was based upon a crude Christianity. This kind of Christianity was invented, preached, and propagated by the Jews. Therefore, the Jews have made this war. Please don't think that this is a joke. It only seems a joke, and behind it there lurks a gigantic truth, and it is this, that all latter-day ideas and movements have originally sprung from a Jewish source, for the simple reason that the Semitic idea has finally conquered and entirely subdued this only apparently irreligious universe of ours. There is no doubt that the Jews regularly go one better or worse than the Gentile in whatever they do. There is no further doubt that their influence today justifies a very careful scrutiny and cannot possibly be viewed without serious alarm. The great question, however, is whether the Jews are conscious or unconscious malefactors. I myself am firmly convinced that they are unconscious ones. But please do not think that I wish to exonerate them on that account. A conscious evildoer has my respect, for he knows at least what is good. An unconscious one, well, he needs the charity of Christ, a charity that is not mine, to be forgiven for not knowing what he is doing. But there is, in my firm conviction, not the slightest doubt that these revolutionary Jews do not know what they are doing, that they are more unconscious sinners than voluntary evildoers. I'm glad to see that this was not an original observation of mine, but that you yourself have a very strong foreboding about the Jews being victims of their own theories and principles. On page 39 of your pamphlet, you write, quote, "It may be that the Jews have always been instrumental in bringing about the events that they most heartily disapprove of. That may be the curse of the wandering Jew." End quote. If I had not the honor, as well as the pleasure, of knowing you personally, if I were not strongly aware of your passionate desire for light and your intense loathing of unfairness, this sentence, and this sentence alone, which tells the truth, will absolve you in my eyes from the odious charge of being a vulgar anti-Semite. No, you are not a vulgar, you are a very enlightened critic of our race. For there is anti-Semitism, I hope and trust, which does the Jews more justice than any blind philo-Semitism, than does that merely sentimental let-them-all-come liberalism, which in itself is nothing but the Semitic ideology over again. And thus you can be just to the Jews without being romantic about them. you have noticed with alarm that the Jewish elements provide the driving forces for both communism and capitalism, and for the material as well as the spiritual ruin of the world. But then you have, at the same time, the profound suspicion that the reason for all this extraordinary behavior may be the intense idealism of the Jew. In this, you are perfectly right. The Jew, if caught by an idea, never thinks any more in watertight compartments, as do the Teuton and Anglo-Saxon peoples, whose right cerebral hemisphere never seems to know what its left twin brother is doing. He, the Jew, like the Russian, at once begins to practice what he preaches. He draws the logical conclusion from his tenets. He invariably acts upon his accepted principles. It is from this quality, no doubt, that springs his mysterious force. That force which you no doubt condemn, but which you had to admire even in the Bolsheviks. And we must admire it, whether we are Jews or whether we are Christians. For have not these modern Jews remained true to type? Is there no parallel for them in history? Do they not go to the bitter end even in our day? Who stirred up the people during the late war in Germany? Who pretended to have again the truth, that truth about which Pontius Pilate once shrugged his shoulders? Who pleaded for honesty and cleanliness in politics, that honesty which brings a smile to the lips of any experienced proconsul of today? Writers who were mostly Jews: Fried, Fernow, Latsko, Richard Grelling, the author of J'accuse, who was killed and allowed himself to be killed for these very ideas and principles. Men and women of the Jewish race: Haas, Levine, Luxemburg, Landauer, Kurt Eisner, the Prime Minister of Bavaria. From Moses to Marx, from Isaiah to Eisner, in practice and in theory, in idealism and in materialism, in philosophy and in politics, they are today what they have always been, passionately devoted to their aims and to their purposes, and ready, nay, eager, to shed their last drop of blood for the realization of their visions. But these visions are all wrong, you will surely reply. Look where they have had led the world to. Think that they have now had a fair trial of 3,000 years standing. How much longer are you going to recommend them to us and to afflict them upon us? And how do you propose to get us out of the morass into which you have launched us, if you do not change the path upon which you have led the world so disastrously astray? To this question that you ask, I have only one answer to give, and it is this. You are right. This reproach of yours, which I feel it for certain, is at the bottom of your anti-Semitism, is only too well justified, and upon this common ground I am quite willing to shake hands with you and defend you against any accusation of promoting race hatred. If you are anti-Semite, I, the Semite, am an anti-Semite too, and a much more fervent one than you, even you are. We, the Jews, have erred, my friend. We have most grievously erred. And if there was truth in our error, 3,000, 2,000, nay, 100 years ago, there is nothing but falseness and madness, a madness that will produce an even greater misery and an even wider anarchy. I confess it to you, openly and sincerely, and with a sorrow whose depth and pain an ancient psalmist, and only he, could moan into this burning universe of ours. We who have posed as the saviors of the world, we who have even boasted of having given it the Savior, we are today nothing else but the world's seducers, its destroyers, its incendiaries, its executioners. We who have promised to lead you to a new heaven, we have finally succeeded in landing you in a new hell. There has been no progress. least of all moral progress. And it is just our morality which has prohibited all real progress and, what is worse, which even stands in the way of every future and natural reconstruction in this ruined world of ours. I look at this world and I shudder at its ghastliness. I shudder all the more as I know the spiritual authors of all this ghastliness. But its authors themselves, unconscious in this, as in all they are doing, know nothing yet of this startling revelation. While Europe is aflame, while its victims scream, while its dogs howl in the conflagration, and while its very smoke descends in darker and even darker shades upon our continent, the Jews, or at least a part of them, and by no means the most unworthy ones, endeavor to escape from the burning building, and wish to retire from Europe into Asia, from the somber scene of our disaster, into the sunny corner of their Palestine. Their eyes are closed to the miseries, their ears are deaf to the moanings, their heart is hardened to the anarchy of Europe. They only feel their own sorrows, they only bewail their own fate, they only sigh under their own burdens. They know nothing of their duty to Europe, which looks around in vain for help and guidance. They know nothing even of their own great ancestor, to whose heart the appeal of pity was never made in vain. They have become too poor in love, too sick at heart, too tired of battle, and lo! These sons of those who were once the bravest soldiers are now trying to retire from the trenches to the rear, are now eager to exchange the grim music of the whistling shells with that of cowbells and vintage songs in the happy plain of Sharon. And yet, we are not all financiers. We're not all Bolsheviks. We have not all become Zionists. And yet, there is hope, great hope, that this same race which has provided the evil will likewise succeed in supplying its antidote, its remedy, the good. It has always been so in the past. Was not that fatal liberalism, which finally led to Bolshevism, in the very midst of that dark 19th century, most strenuously opposed by two enlightened Jews? Friedrich Stahl, the founder of the Conservative Party in Germany, and by Benjamin Disraeli, the leader of the Tory party in England. And if these two eminent men had no suspicion yet that their own race and its holy message were at the bottom of that unfortunate upheaval with which their age was confronted, how eager, how determined, how passionate will be the opposition of the Disraelis of the future once they have clearly recognized that they are really fighting the tenets of their own people, and that it was their good, their love, their ideal that had launched the world into this hell of evil and hatred. A new good as new love, a true love, an intelligent love, a love that calms and heals and sweetens, will then spring up among the great in Israel, and overcome that sickly love, that insipid love, that romantic love, which has hitherto poisoned all the strength and all the nobility of this world. For hatred is never overcome by hatred, it is only overcome by love, and it wants a new and a gigantic love to subdue that old and devilish hatred of today. That is our task for the future. A task that will, I'm sure, not be shirked by Israel. By that same Israel that has never shirked a task, whether it was for good or whether it was for evil. Yes, there is hope, my friend, for we are still here. Our last word is not yet spoken. Our last deed is not yet done. Our last revolution is not yet made. This last revolution, the revolution that will crown our revolutionaries, will be the revolution against the revolutionaries. It is bound to come, and it is perhaps upon us now. The great day of reckoning is near. It will pass a judgment upon our ancient faith, and it will lay the foundation to a new religion. And when that great day has broken, when the values of death and decay are put into the melting pot to be changed into those of power and beauty, then you, my dear Pitt Rivers, the descendant of an old distinguished Gentile family, may be assured to find by your side, and as your faithful ally, at least one member of that Jewish race which has fought with such fatal success upon all the spiritual battlefields of Europe. Yours against the revolution and for life ever flourishing, signed, Oscar Levy, Royal Societies Club, St. James Street, London, Southwest, July 1920. That is the end of the first half of today's episode. This first article was published April 30th, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. Well, there you go. Oscar Levy, a Jew around 100 years ago who told the truth and admitted it as such, and admitted that Jews were behind nearly all the revolutions of Europe at the time. It's a most, astonishing admission. Of course, I can't help but disagree with the sentiments in the latter part of the letter that Jews are capable of undoing what they have done. I don't believe that to be the case. There can be, I guess, Jews like Oscar Levy who switch sides and turncoat and switch sides in the middle of the war. Just like there's Gentiles who have joined Team Satan and fight with the Jews. I suppose it's possible, but he says, we are not all financiers, they're not all Rothschilds, they're not all Bolsheviks, and they're not all Zionists. Well, yeah, there's an exception to every rule, I suppose, but the Jews have got to be stripped of all their power, of all their influence, all their money, all their prestige, all their power, for things to be turned around. And then you have the problem of the Gentiles just being stupid. Stupid, short-sighted, and not caring. That's a huge problem. The Jews could not have pulled off what they have pulled off, let's just say in the last 100 years since the writing of this, of these articles in the Dearborn Independent. They could have never pulled this off if Gentiles weren't stupid. And unfortunately, they are. So Oscar Levy thinks that the Jews are unconscious doers of evil in our world. Well, that may be too. If you look at biology and DNA and how it programs people's behaviors and actions. I was reading this and I couldn't help but think back to, I guess, the biblical or scriptural understanding that I have, and more or less that the Jews are damned. The Jews are damned. They deny that Yahshua Christ was God come in the flesh. They still to this day refuse it, deny it. These people are truly damned to hell. There is no righteousness in them. Anyways, let's move on to part two before we get carried away here ranting and raving. Okay, the second half of today's episode, this article is entitled The Jewish Idea in American Monetary Affairs. Mr. Brisbane says that Jewish bankers exercise their large measure of control because they are abler than the other bankers. It was very good of Mr. Brisbane to say so, and it adds to the sum of his weekly, almost daily, worship at the Jewish shrine, but it is scarcely true. Jewish bankers do not yet control the United States, and the principal reason that they do not is that they are not abler than the other bankers. Doubtless, they seek control. Doubtless, they have almost grasped it on several occasions, but not yet. Nevertheless, they form a formidable force, and with their international connections, constitute such a political problem that the mere fact of their failing to top the column of control is not so reassuring as it sounds. The great Jewish banking houses of the United States are foreign importations, as perhaps everyone knows. Most of them are sufficiently recent to be considered in their immigrant status, while the thought of them as aliens is stimulated by their retention of overseas connections. It is this international quality of the Jewish banking group which largely accounts for Jewish financial power. There is team play, intimate understandings, and while there is a margin of competition among themselves, just like at golf, there is also a wiping out of that margin when it comes to a contest between Jewish and, quote, Gentile capital. Four conspicuous contemporary names in Jewish American finance are Belmont, Schiff, Warburg, and Kahn. All of them, even the most recent, are of foreign origin. August Belmont was the earliest and arrived in America in 1837 as the American representative of the Rothschilds in whose offices he had been raised. That's right, he was a de facto kind of adopted Rothschild. Continuing on, his birthplace was that great center of Jewish international finance, Frankfurt on the Main. He became the founder of the Belmont family in America, which has largely forgotten its Jewish origin. Politics was a part of his concern in this country, and during the critical time from 1860 to 1872, he was chairman of the National Democratic Committee. His management of the Rothschild interests was exceedingly profitable to that house, although the operations in which he engaged were quite simple compared with the operations of the present day. Jacob Schiff is another Jewish financier who was given to the world by Frankfurt on the Main, Rothschild. He entered the United States in 1865 after having passed his apprenticeship in the office of his father, who was also an agent of the Rothschilds. The name Schiff runs a long way back without change, unlike the name of Rothschild. Originally named Bauer, this family of financiers took a new name from the red shield which adorned their house in the Jewish section of Frankfurt and thus became Rothschild, Red Shield. Commonly, the last syllable is pronounced as if it were child. It is shield. Shield. An epic-making family in itself, it has trained hundreds of agents and apprentices, of whom Jacob H. Schiff was one. He became one of the principal channels through which German Jewish capital flowed into American undertakings, and his agency in these matters gave him a place in many important departments of American business, especially railroads, banks, insurance companies, and telegraph companies. Jacob Schiff married Teresa Loeb, and in due time came to be head of the firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Mr. Schiff, too, was interested in politics with a Jewish angle, and was perhaps the moving force in the campaign which forced Congress and the President to break off treaty relations with Russia, then a friendly nation, on a strictly Jewish question which had been skillfully given an American aspect. Mr. Schiff was of inestimable assistance to Japan in the war against Russia, but is understood to have been disappointed by Japan's shrewdness in preventing too high a return being made for that assistance. Associated with Mr. Schiff and Kuhn, Loeb & Company is Otto Hermann Kahn, who is probably more international than were either of the two gentlemen mentioned above, and is more constantly engaged in dabbling in mysterious matters of an international nature. This characteristic may be accounted for, however, by his experience of many countries. He was born in Germany and is also a product of the Frankfurt-on-the-Main School of Finance, having had connection with the Frankfurt Jewish House of Speyer. Of just how many countries Mr. Kahn has been a citizen is a question not easy to determine here because of the doubt that was recently cast upon his American citizenship by a protest against his being permitted to cast his vote last year, and by his failure, the announced cause being physical indisposition, to cast his vote. If Mr. Kahn is a citizen of the United States, That probably increases the number of his citizenships to 3. He was a German citizen by birth and served in the German army. And in 1914, in August, at the time of the outbreak of the European War, when efforts were being made, which afterwards succeeded, to put Paul M. Warburg, a member of the firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company, on the Federal Reserve Board, Mr. Warburg testified that at the time, Mr. Kahn was not a citizen of the United States. Here we have an exchange between Senator Bristow and Mr. Warburg. Senator Bristow says, "How many of these partners are American citizens, or are they all American citizens?" Mr. Warburg responds, "They are all American citizens except Mr. Kahn." So, if Mr. Kahn is a citizen of the United States now, which as a matter of fact has been disputed, then he has been a citizen of 3 countries, Germany and Great Britain being the other 2. Mr. Kahn, by the way, is one of those Jews whose adoption of another form of faith brings no denunciation, whatever, from the Jews themselves. A most peculiar circumstance, but doubtless not inexplicable. Mr. Kahn is not called a renegade Jew, nor any of the other nasty names heaped upon Jewish converts to Christianity, because he does not deserve them. They would not fit him. He is not a renegade. And he never was regarded for a moment by Jacob H. Schiff as anything but a Jew, else that Prince of Israel would not have chosen him to remain in America and run the business of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, at a time when it seemed undesirable to put the junior Schiff in full charge of it. Doubtless it was Mr. Kahn's desire, just at the time Jacob Schiff made his wishes known, to go to England and stand for Parliament. But from New York he fulfills, probably as well as he could from London, those mysterious missions which frequently take him to the continent, at which times he makes what are regarded as certain authoritative decisions, though just whose decisions it is not always possible to say. In Paris particularly, and at points east thereof, Mr. Kahn has been established in the position of spokesman of the American financial hierarchy, which, of course, he is not. But he undoubtedly is the spokesman of some group, possibly the group that so ably put through the Jewish program at the peace conference, the group that impressed Eastern Europe with the feeling that the United States of America was a very powerful Semitic empire. Mr. Kahn's trips abroad are usually unheralded, but their results richly repay observation. A 4th member of the Jewish financial group in America, which is the form of statement which Mr. Chaim Weizmann would sanction rather than to say Jewish American financiers, is Mr. Paul Warburg, to whose testimony we have just alluded. Mr. Warburg is the most recent of all. He was born in Germany in 1868. He came to the United States in 1902. He became an American citizen in 1911. He came to the U.S. for the express purpose of reforming our financial system, and it is hardly possible to understand fully the system in operation today without reference to Paul Warburg. He is a man of very fine mind, a moneymaker, but something more, a shrewd student of the systems by which money is made. There are 2 types engaged in the mere work of moneymaking, which is better described as money-getting, without reference to production. One type grubs away under whatever system obtains, regarding it as fixed as the solar system. Another type is sufficiently detached to see the system as an artifice that may be mended, remodeled, or supplanted altogether. Paul Warburg, scion of a long line of German Jewish bankers, is of the latter type. He is not content with the fact that the cash register fills itself with money. He wants also to know how the cash register works and whether it can be worked. He is thus a student of money and of the number of ways in which it can be manipulated. Perhaps it will be best to let him tell his own story as far as he goes. When he told it to the Committee on Banking and Currency of the United States Senate in executive session, there was some dispute as to whether the proceedings should be recorded by stenographer. It was finally agreed that notes should be made, but should not be divulged. The testimony was printed in confidence on August 5, 1914, and nominally made public on August 12. The Warburgs are one of the international families whose importance was not realized until the war, and would not have been realized then if their internationalism had not been so apparent. It was an interesting spectacle to see brothers occupying important places of counsel on either side of the great struggle. Paul Warburg learned the rudiments of banking in his father's bank at Hamburg, Germany, studying the overseas trade that is the foundation of that city's business. The banking house of Warburg in Hamburg dates from 1796. He says, quote, "After that, I went to England, where I stayed for 2 years, first in the banking and discount firm of Central Montag and Company, and after that I took the opportunity of staying 2 months in the office of a stockbroker in order to learn that part of the business. After that, I went to France, where I stayed in a French bank, so that..." Mr. Chairman of the committee then interrupts him, asking, "What French bank was that?" Warburg responds, "It is the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade, which has an agency in Paris. And after that, I went back to Hamburg and worked there again for a year, I think. Then I went round to India, China, and Japan. And then I came to this country for the first time in 1893. I stayed here only a short time then, and went back to Hamburg, and then became a partner of the firm in Hamburg." Mr. Chairman then asks him, "How long were you in Hamburg, then in the banking business?" Warburg responds, "Until 1902, and then I moved over here to this country to become a partner of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. I explained in the curriculum which I gave you, Mr. Chairman, that by marriage I am related to members of the firm, to the late Mr. Loeb, having been my father-in-law, which brought about a desire on the part of the family to bring me over here. I ought to say that I got married in this country in 1895, and that I have been in this country every year since, for several months. That is the history of my banking education." It will be recalled that Jacob H. Schiff also married a daughter of Mr. Loeb, so that Mr. Warburg married the sister of Mrs. Jacob H. Schiff. Felix Warburg, Paul's brother, who's also in the firm, married Mr. Schiff's daughter. Mr. Warburg immediately cast a critical eye upon the state of financial affairs in the U.S., and it is significant of the grasp he already had on such matters that he found the country rather behind the times. He conceived the ambition, the very daring ambition, of taking hold of the United States monetary system and making it what he thought it ought to be. This alone would make him a remarkable man. It illustrates very well that detached point of view which the Jew is more fitted to take than any other man, perhaps. He sees countries and systems with the same freedom from intimate bias with which another man would view assorted fish upon a market stall. Most of the world is engaged in doing its work and indulging its national, racial, domestic, and social affections and inclinations. A small minority stands in the background and watches the entire mass at its unconscious maneuvers, and studies it as an observer studies a hive of bees. The man at work has no time except for his job. One man, standing back and studying 1,000 men at work, is able to see how he might utilize their labor or possess himself of a first toll on their production. Doubtless, there must be men to stand at a sufficient distance from things to get a correct idea of their interrelationship, and doubtless such an attitude may be made of great service to the race, but doubtless it has also contributed to the selfish manipulation of natural and social processes. Mr. Warburg testified, quote, "When I came here, I was at once impressed by the lack of system, by the old-fashioned nature of the system that prevailed here, and I got immediately into one of those periods of high interest rates where call money went up to 25 and 100%, and I wrote an article on the subject then and there for my own benefit. I was not here 3 weeks before I was trying to explain to myself the roots of the evil. I showed the article to a few friends, but I kept it in my desk, because I did not want to be one of those who try to inform and educate the country after they have been here for a month or so. And I kept that article until the end of 1906, shortly before the panic, when those conditions arose again, and when one newspaper wanted for an issue at the end of the year an article dealing with the conditions in our country. Then I took out that article, touched it up, and brought it up to date, and that was the first article of mine that was published. It was called Defects and Needs of Our Banking System. That was, however, the first time that I know of that the question of the discount system and the concentration of reserves was really brought out, and I got a great many encouraging letters asking me to go on and explain my ideas." Mr. Warburg was perfectly willing to talk to the committee about himself, but not about Kuhn, Loeb & Company, his firm. "I cannot discuss the affairs of my firm nor my partners," he said, "nor be asked to criticize acts of my partners, either to approve them or in any other way." But eventually he did tell a number of things which students of American financial affairs have considered interesting, of which we will cover more of those later. On page 77 of the testimony, more personal matters appear. Senator Bristow: "When did you become a citizen of the United States, Mr. Warburg?" Warburg responds: "In 1911. Did I not answer that?" Bristow responds: "Perhaps so. Did you intend to become a citizen when you came to the U.S. in 1902? Mr. Warburg replies: "I had no definite intentions then, because some of the reasons that brought me over here were family reasons. That had a good deal to do with my first coming here, and I was not sure at all that I would stay here when I came." Bristow then asks him, "When did you decide to become a citizen of the United States?" Warburg responds, saying, "In 1908, when I took out my papers." Senator Bristow follows up, asking him, "When you took out your first papers? You took out your second papers then in 1911, right?" Mr. Warburg responds, "Yes." Bristow says, "You made your declaration in 1908. That's when you decided to become an American citizen?" Mr. Warburg responds, saying, "Yes." Senator Bristow then asks, "Why did you wait as long as you did after you came to this country before deciding to become a citizen of the country?" Warburg responds, saying, "I think that a man does not come here as an immigrant. A man who has had, if you may call it such, a prominent position in his own country will not give up his nationality so easily as a man who comes over here knowing that he does not care for his own country at all. I had been a very loyal citizen of my own country, and I think that a man who hesitates in giving up his own nationality and taking a new one is apt to be more loyal to his new country when he does change his nationality than a man who gives up his old country more lightly." Senator Bristow then responds to that, saying, "Yes." Mr. Warburg goes on, "I may add this, that a thing which had a great deal of influence on my making up my mind to remain in this country and work here, and become a part and parcel of this country, was that monetary reform work, for I felt I had a distinct duty to perform here, and I thought I could do that, and in fact I have been working on it since 1906 or 1907. And then I felt that it was the right thing for me to become an American citizen and work here and throw in my lot definitely with this country." Senator Bristow asks him, "When you became an American citizen and the motive which you induced, you to become an American citizen was then, as I understand it, largely with a view of laboring to bring about a reform of the American monetary system? Warburg responds, saying, "Well, you put it nearly exclusively on that. I think a man wants to feel that he is going to do some useful work in his country, that he has a mission to perform, and that is what happened to me. Moreover, I had been long enough in this country then to have thoroughly taken root and feel that I was part and parcel of it." Senator Bristow says, "Yes. When did you first become active in promoting the monetary reforms in the U.S.?" Warburg responds, saying, "In 1906. Senator Bristow asks him, "What was your method of promoting your ideas with regard to monetary reforms?" Warburg responds, saying, "Mainly in writing." Senator Bristow, "Were you connected with the Monetary Commission?" Warburg responds, "No, not directly." Senator Bristow says, "Were you consulted in regard to the report of the Monetary Commission in any way?" Warburg responds, saying, "Yes, Senator Aldrich consulted with me about details, and I gave him my advice freely." Senator Bristow goes on, saying, "And in regard to the bill which was prepared by Senator Aldrich in connection with the commission, were you consulted in regard to that?" Warburg responds, saying, "Yes." Bristow then asks him, "What part did you have in the preparation of that bill, directly or indirectly?" Warburg responds, saying, "Well, only that I gave the best advice that I could give." Okay, that is the end of the exchange here. Back to the main text. Most readers will recall that the name of Aldrich was, a few years ago, the synonym for the money power in the government. Senator Aldrich was an able man and a tireless worker. His character for thoroughness and industry did more than anything else to disabuse the popular mind of the notion that such men were mere tools of the money interest, or engaged in their work out of lust for gain, or out of sheer pleasure in legislating against the interests of the people. Senator Aldrich led on tariff and financial matters because he understood them, and he understood them by tireless study of them, and, therefore, he was the master of other men who had not paid the price of knowledge. But he understood these matters from the standpoint of the business interests only. He was sincerely desirous of the prosperity of the country, but that prosperity was written in banking balances. 15 years ago, it might not have been possible to judge him thus calmly, because then he represented in the public mind, more than any other individual does today, the concentrated power of the financial group. Their prosperity was his first care, possibly because he believed that their prosperity was also the country's prosperity. It was such a man, then, that came to Mr. Warburg for advice. The labors of Senator Nelson Aldrich comprised many volumes of difficult material, and Senator Aldrich's appeal to Mr. Warburg was a very high compliment to the quality of the latter's mind and financial experience. This, of course, assuming that Mr. Warburg's counsel was not forced upon the Aldrich community by the New York money interests. In his testimony, Mr. Warburg did not tell all. The omission, however, was supplied by an article in Leslie's Weekly in 1916, the author being B.C. Forbes, in a story of which current opinion said this, quote, "It reads like the opening in a shilling shocker." It appears that the conferences between Mr. Warburg and Senator Aldrich took place on an isolated island off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island. Included in the party, besides Senator Aldrich and Mr. Warburg, were two New York bankers and the then Assistant Treasurer of the United States. The mysteriousness of it all was well brought out by Mr. Forbes. Quote, "Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York on a private railroad car under cover of darkness, stealthily hieing hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking out to an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such rigid secrecy that the name of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servitors learn their identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret episode in the history of American finance. The utmost secrecy was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done. Senator Aldrich notified each one to go quietly into a private car, which the railroad had received orders to draw up at an unfrequented platform. Drawn blinds balked any peering eyes that might be around. Off the party had set. New York's ubiquitous reporters had been foiled. So far, so good. After bowling along the railroad hour after hour into southern country, the order was given to prepare to disembark. Stepping from the car when the station had been well cleared of travelers, the members of the expedition embarked in a small boat. Silence reigned, for the boatmen must not find out how distinguished were their passengers. In due time, they drew up at another deserted pier. They were at Jekyll Island, off Georgia. The island was entirely unpeopled, save for half a dozen servants. "The servants must, under no circumstances, learn who we are," cautioned Senator Aldrich. "What can we do to fool them?" asked another member of the group. The problem was discussed. "I have it," cried one. "Let's all call each other by our first names. Don't ever let us mention our last names." And so it was agreed upon. The dignified veteran, Senator Aldrich, King of Rhode Island in a power second to none in the United States Senate, became just Nelson, and the quiet, scholarly member of the powerful international banking firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company became simply Paul. Nelson had meanwhile confided to Harry, Frank, Paul, and Pyatt that he was to keep them locked up on Jekyll Island, cut off from the rest of the world, until they had evolved and compiled a scientific currency system for the United States, a system that would embody all that was best in Europe, yet so modeled that it could serve a country measuring thousands where European countries measured only hundreds of miles. Mr. Forbes does not omit to write this further description of Mr. Warburg's condition at the time. Unable then to speak idiomatic English with perfect freedom and without an accent, an alien not naturalized. Mr. Forbes also wrote that, "Here is a German-American, but the sort of one that makes the hyphen look like a badge of honor." That was written in 1916. Hyphens went out of fashion, though not entirely out of use, soon after. Thus far, the story of Paul Warburg. And that is the end of the second half of today's episode. This was published on June 18th, 1921 in the Dearborn Independent. Well, I was wondering when we would get to the Federal Reserve in this lengthy series, and it seems we have finally gotten there, and Henry and his editors did not miss this gem of Jewish conspiracy. Since we're discussing the topic, I will reference you to other works. You know, the first person to write a book about the secret meeting in Jekyll Island and the Federal Reserve Act, the Federal Reserve System, was, of course, Eustace Mullins. Eustace Mullins was a teenage or early 20s protege of Ezra Pound. And Ezra Pound knew quite well about the Jewish conspiracy and how the Jews were taking control of all the capitals of Europe and in America via the money power controlling the money and credit system of the United States. He knew it. Eustace Mullins had the great luck into bouncing into him. FDR and his administration locked Ezra Pound away in St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital in Washington, D.C., or on the East Coast somewhere, and for talking about it. Anyway, Eustace was attending an art college at the time, and the teacher, the instructor of this art college, happened to be friends with Ezra Pound, and Ezra wanted visitors, so Eustace went and talked to this man, and Ezra Pound commissioned Eustace Mullins to go to the Library of Congress and research this and what angles to take and to write the book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, as a mystery thriller novel to make it intriguing and make it appealing for folks to read. He didn't want it to be dry and mundane and unremarkable. So anyways, that's the story of that. Eustace Mullins and Ezra Pound, those are two remarkable American figures that you could dig into sometime and be quite amazed at what you learn. Anyways, it's so important to point out that Warburg, Schiff, August Belmont, all these folks are intimately tied into the Rothschild family, and they're really, I guess, the root of the tree, the head of the snake, so to speak, when it comes to international finance and control of the world's money supply. They are the king family of the Jews, as I understand it. And Jacob Schiff is the one who gave Lenin and Trotsky the $100 million worth of gold and a sealed train car to go from Germany to Russia. And more or less, Jacob Schiff commissioned the Bolshevik Revolution. And Jacob Schiff was more or less an adopted Rothschild, as was August Belmont during the time of the Civil War. So, again, you just cannot escape these very, very telling connections to this Rothschild family throughout major events in American history, but also European history, too. At least as far back as the last 300 years or so. Well, that's it for today's episode. I don't have too much more to rant or rave about, so we will see you on the flip side. Until next time, this is Ted Midward signing off. You are listening to RadioArian.com. Praise Christ. Praise Yahweh. Take care. Bye-bye. Dude.